Thank you for coming out today for the morning or the day or however long you're here. The Buddha Dharma is so practical. There's this philosopher, writer, Sam Harris. Anyone know Sam Harris? Who's got some books on critique of religion in the modern world and the moral landscape. I think about kind of like how ethics and morality can be backed up by science without need for religion. And he's got a quite interesting book on free will and the lack thereof, kind of from without using Dharma, basically the teachings of no self to show that there's not really such thing as free will. And his latest book's called Waking Up. I was listening to the first chapters he offers as an audio talk, and some people are critical of Sam Harris because he's so critical of religion, and so I think I might agree with some of them. He's tries to poke at anything that looks like superstition or beliefs that actually create more division and separation. But in this book, he's willing to look at Buddhism as not really a religion, and he actually is quite critical of any kind of like ritual, ceremonial stuff of Buddhism that's like, which he says is the same stuff you find in every religion. But he, his feeling is like the principles of Buddha Dharma are so straightforward and practical and beneficial, particularly teachings about no separate self and about freedom from suffering. So I think the Buddha in his time too grew up in a very religious culture and was trying to kind of get to the heart of what this life is about and what's most important. And the freedom from suffering seems like the most practical thing one could ever address. Maybe we could come up with other things, but it just seems that if there's suffering in this world, then let's put our attention into alleviating it in ourselves and others. And Shantideva, as you may have heard, brings up something like, well, there seems to be suffering across the world of sentient beings, but it's not so much that there's a possessor or owner of the suffering. It seems like there's my suffering and your suffering, and as soon as we get into that, we can't help thinking, well, my suffering is more important to alleviate. So Shantideva encourages us to train our minds through considering this again and again, that nobody owns suffering. Therefore, let's just relieve all the suffering we can find, irregardless of whether it's mine or yours. So I think that's the beautiful expression of the Bodhisattva path. Let's alleviate discontent, suffering, distress, irregardless of whose it is. And then, of course, the Buddha's teaching goes into the fact that there's sentient beings in many realms, one of which is the human realm. So in the human realm, I feel like there's many things we do to alleviate suffering in the very practical sense of trying to house the homeless and feed the hungry and heal the sick, amongst many other things. And as far as practices at Zen Center, in this practical way, this, you know, cooking the soup for a local shelter is a gesture towards feeding those who would have a hard time feeding themselves. And maybe the main way we address suffering in the human world is this, Zazen. And so for those of us who know how this works, even to sit for a long time where it might be physically painful, we understand already that this is actually in the direction of alleviating our own suffering. Quite strangely. And I think we see it because the when we go right to the root of it, any conceptual grasping is suffering, is discontent, is not complete peace. So we just let go, we just open that conceptual grip in Zazen. And then if we do it a lot, we get to look at how that works more deeply. So so I think that's the function of a one-day sitting, is to actually alleviate suffering, or, you know, look at its roots. And it's almost like exploring the roots of suffering in the most deepest possible way. And then we have the hungry ghost realm, and so we do this ceremony around Halloween and in the summer too, and actually every week at evening service, to put our intentions forward towards liberating this kind of like spirit, unseen spirit world of hungry ghosts. And hell beings, I think, are included in there. One of the Dharanis in that chant is breaking down the gates of hell. So I think that all these beings that we can't see, real or unreal, with location, without location, any subtle energy that's just like trapped in a kind of like needy or averse place. We just put forth that intention to open that up and free it. And the Deva realm, they say, is not so much suffering, actually, but it's still part of samsara. Long, very long life, very comfortable life. The celestial god realm. But there too, we wish that Buddha taught the devas, taught them dharma, so they could be completely free from suffering. And you know, here, Ida Songten is, strictly speaking, a deva. Ten is the Japanese translation of deva. So he's a Ida deva. Sometimes said to be a bodhisattva also, so maybe devas can be on the bodhisattva path, but some kind of like, again, maybe unseen beings that have a lot of freedom and are like doing pretty well, but we make offerings to Ida Songten and ask him to help protect other sentient beings. So it's kind of like, you could say that's helping free Ida Songten from just like, just blissing out in the deva realm. It's kind of saying, you could please enjoy your blissful realm, but also remember your bodhisattva vow to help, you know, protect this temple and protect others who come here. So kind of encouraging the devas to practice the bodhisattva way and become completely free from any kind of like indulgence in their bliss. So then we have the animal realm. And so we do this ceremony to, you know, in a very practical way, free these beings who would probably die more quickly in a kind of a pretty frightening, could we say, violent way, maybe natural way, in the mouth of a snake or reptile, but still, I wouldn't envy being one of them at that time. So it's a little tricky because it's like, I was considering, well, would it be better? Would it be better if we bought all the crickets everywhere in Santa Cruz, so that none of them would go to feed reptiles? Then the reptiles would starve. So I don't know. I think we don't get into that. We're not going to buy them all. So it might not be good, right? So I think I can't comprehend, you know, how to like, yeah, help work things out in this vast animal realm. There's many different ways to look at it, right? But I feel like to actually buy, you know, this is, I think, 222 crickets, thereabouts. Doesn't look like that many, but I think on the bottom of those cartons, there's probably a very lot. And so some will go to reptiles, but these ones won't. So some won't, right? And I think that's my feeling is like, well, is that kind of silly? Or like, is it, that's some little thing? And my feeling just personally is like, it's a very joyful thing to like, be like, these beings are going to have a different kind of life. And the more I kind of like open to them as sentient beings, in a way they're not that different from us. But they have, I guess they have maybe more arms and legs, but they have arms and legs, right? And they have two eyes, maybe something like a nose and a mouth, and there are various, like, you know, internal systems are not that different. I mean, this is all relatively speaking, right? They're pretty different in many ways. And I think worms are even more different, right? Because they don't have arms and legs. So maybe harder to relate to. So that's a little bit biased, maybe. There's the sentient beings that seem more like us are easier to relate to. So I got more crickets than worms. Maybe because of my personal bias like that, right? Well, worms, I don't know. But then when I was trying to look at them and I couldn't see them under the sawdust, but I could hear them, even when the lid's on, if you put your ear up to it, they're constantly moving around. I think that's different than like a flower or something. I feel some kind of like a sentient life energy that's doing something in there. So we don't know how long they'll live after we release them. And that's the practical part, though, is that they do will probably live out their somewhat short lifespan. Apparently crickets live around 2 months, maybe kind of like tops. And I got this food this time, in case they're not used to scavenging in the garden. And on the way to the Southwest on this recent trip that Shoho and I went to Colorado, and in those landscapes of the Southwest, there's a different feeling because the landscape is so vast. It's like it's so much about space and vast hugeness and the Grand Canyon. We're at the Grand Canyon and we're like all these people there, and they're like, why are all these people like drawn to this place? And because it's so grand. So then we started using this word of driving through the landscape. Wow, this is a grand view. We come up to the top of a hill and you can see, sometimes I think maybe you can see 50 miles, I would guess, or maybe more, I don't know exactly, in any direction. And it's unusual, like in a city or a forest. And it feels different when you're in this vast, grand landscape. There's a feeling of spaciousness. I almost feel like maybe more, the body is more relaxed and maybe more like buoyant, because it feels like there's so much space here. It doesn't feel constricted. And along the way, we stopped at a pet store and got some crickets and did this ceremony on the side of the highway somewhere in one of these vast landscapes. And Shoho brought up, I really feel like what this is about is like giving these beings a vaster view. Because we're having this vaster view, and it really seems it's more like, it's somewhat liberating just to drive through that kind of landscape. So these crickets that I think in that time were actually, they came in this tiny little like cardboard box about this big, like 30 of them or something, with this little hole, and it was decorated like a little house. And I think when you put it in the snake terrarium or whatever, and then you just open the door and they just come out of the house one at a time and get eaten, and they're kind of like and they're kind of, you know,
like
self-timed. What's that?
It sounds like a setup.
Yeah, a setup. But this, so we kind of opened up this little house into this vast landscape, and they just delightedly go hopping away out into the desert wilderness. And we don't know how crickets perceive the world through their tiny little eyes and ears and brain. But I have the maybe naive sense that they have some sense of spaciousness like that. When they leave that tiny little house, or when they leave their little crate here into the open with no boundaries, no walls anymore, and they can just move as far as they want and anywhere, and they can do whatever they want, and they can commune with the plants and the soil and the other parts of the earth where they would usually live. And now maybe their intelligence is not so great, but maybe they have some sense of opening, and then, you know, in their short lifespan, and maybe that plants a seed. Maybe that's like creates a condition for their next life. Maybe they're less feeling of like born into this kind of constricted karmic fruit, and more like born into like some sense of like enjoying openness and space. Well, I think that's one way of looking at this kind of thing. And then we do our human thing, this Buddhist ceremony that someone like Sam Harris would say, why don't you just release the crickets? I can see that's a practical relieving of suffering. But, you know, teaching them about the three refuges and the 12-fold chain of causation and the name of Ratna Shikan Tathagata, who apparently made this vow in ancient, ancient times, that any sentient beings who hear that name, Ratna Shikan Tathagata, in their next life would be born into a conducive realm for practice. So as this wacky religious superstition, maybe so, maybe it's about our intention. That's how I see these things, like the Sajiki ceremony and these ceremony for these animals, is it's using our human realm of like our understanding of Buddha's teachings, and we're talking in human language that crickets probably don't know. They're probably not going to understand our English words, but they might understand if we're speaking and acting, if we're doing it with the intention, they might actually pick up on intention. I think this is the whole, this is my understanding of like how prayer would work in general. It's not really about the words, but the but intention creates the world. And we can feel it when, you know, walking around in the world and people with different intentions without them saying anything. Sometimes it's body language or facial expressions, but sometimes even more subtle than that, I think. Intentions have effects. So in the realm of subtle mind that we share with all sentient beings, in the realm of Buddha nature, that's like the deepest, truest, most boundless, aware quality of mind that the Buddhas teach all sentient beings are endowed with. And maybe in that realm, we subtle intentions intermingle. So we might say, just to recite words, like a mantra, for example, without any particular intention, does that have an effect? And that's, I think, an interesting topic for contemplation. And I think some would say, no, it actually doesn't. It's all about the intention behind it. And some would say, yes, because, you know, particularly with a mantra, that some sentient being put, like, super strong intention into this particular sound with kind of connected it with the sound, so that then later beings who connect with that sound connect with the original being's intention. I think it's still the principle of intention, but it's getting a little far out in that understanding. So, liberating life in sitting on the cushion, freeing small animals, hungry ghosts and devas, into a vaster landscape. Less enclosed space. And that way, like, our mind on the cushion, we're kind of like breaking down the gates of hell. We're kind of opening the cricket box. We're peeling the layers of limited conceptual constructs away to open into vastness. Any thoughts or questions or thoughts?
Yes. I was just thinking. I think a lot of the precepts about speech are about that same thing. About liberating other beings, well, and ourselves too. Because often our speech is limiting,
yeah,
negative in some way,
yep,
confining,
mm-hmm, confining ourselves and others. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of think about it in that way, and I think about that the you know precept about not killing others. It's, I think, the speech and, you know, can also be a way of kind of killing the life in someone.
Yeah.
Not literally, but more figuratively.
Yeah, definitely.
Because, you know, I'm not a vegetarian, but so I kind of think about kind of those other aspects.
Yeah.
Of not taking life.
Yeah.
Taking.
And limiting life. When we use words that say, you know, you're really not very good at that. You're, you know, that was really like not good. We might say to a little kid, for example, who's trying to find their way in this smallness and vastness, and then maybe they constrict. That puts up these walls. That, yeah, I guess I'm really not so good. I'm, you know, I'm getting into a smaller and smaller box. And words of kind of support and praise kind of like open up that, like, oh, maybe actually I can do anything. So, yeah, in terms of like smallness and vastness, speech can create that feeling in others and ourselves. Mm-hmm. Self-criticism and self-acceptance, internal speech also. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Scott.
Yeah, I just had a question about Sam Harris, and I've heard of this book, Waking Up. I saw something in the New York Times about it, and it sounded really interesting, and I'd like to read it. But I'm just wondering, from your experience of him, does he offer any kind of path or any practice, or is it just
analysis
or his own experience?
In this first chapter, I was surprised just having, I haven't read some of his books, but they're usually very kind of just kind of like philosophy and pointing out things, but this just in the first chapter, I was kind of startled that he's really like teaching Buddhism, even saying like, I usually teach people about vipassana first, or sati, mindfulness, and he goes through the four foundations of mindfulness, he gives a guided meditation instruction, so it's very unusual for my understanding of what he's usually doing is just kind of pointing out kind of social critiques and so on. He's like giving meditation instruction, a little bit to the point of like, and I think he's quite well known, kind of popular writer. So I thought, this is interesting that he's kind of shifted his whole focus to now he's a meditation teacher. Mm-hmm. And he's, and he also mentioned he's got a lot of Buddhist practice that he doesn't mention in his other books. That I know he spent time in Kathmandu, maybe at Rongjung Yeshe years ago, with practicing with Tibetan teachers, and he's done Vipassana retreats and long solo retreats, and he said he's good friends with Joseph Goldstein, a Vipassana teacher. So he's kind of, I think, revealing this kind of secret world he has of his Buddhist practice and offering it to his audience, some of which I imagine some are like, you know, very kind of sort of anti-religious people, and some might turn away at this point. But some, I thought, well, maybe it was all just skillful means in order to draw on these kind of people who are not into religion, maybe wouldn't even look into Buddhism because it's a religion, but into science and straightforward critique of anything that looks suspiciously superstitious. And then with that audience, now we're going to give some meditation instruction. Posture and breathing, just in this first section, complete like guided meditation. And I think it looks like in later chapters he gets into teachings about no self. He does offer practical, and it may be only in this book, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Patrick.
Well, as you were looking at what we share with other sentient beings, I was thinking that, even these crickets or even those worms, they, move towards the stuff that they desire, and they move away from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit more. I think there's studies both directions.
Well, I mean, but nobody's chanting for. I misspoke because people that are connected, do statistically have longer lives and better health, and maybe that's what this religion thing is just all about.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
That over the generations, you unconsciously have seen that we're healthier and we suffer less. And
yeah.
It's a complicated business.
I think that's true, that the religious rituals and ceremonies, and I was also looking recently paging through Aldous Huxley's The Perennial Philosophy. I think a kind of classic Michael Bashista sent me. And he's got, where he's trying to look at like what are the unifying factors of every spiritual tradition. It's kind of the, I think the point of the book. And many different topics and areas. And one of them was like, ritual and ceremony, and I kind of went to that chapter and thought, how's he going to talk about it? And I think he said, similar to you, basically like, yeah, it's just kind of putting expression to the heart principles of any spiritual tradition, and some do that better than others. You know, some are more direct and some aren't so direct, and so I think that, like, and when I, look into, like, this version of this animal release ceremony is from the Soto Zen ceremony manuals, actually, and looking into different translations and the original, this, I eliminated some stuff that feels like it just doesn't, it's extra, it doesn't accord with our understanding and of our culture and so much, but kept the heart of the ceremony. And I think we're always doing that in America especially, is what are the essential elements that point towards expressing our connection and the teachings of the tradition. And then that's where it's not so much just like meaningless superstition anymore. And also another point about like the connection of intentions and healing others through connection and prayer and so on. One Tibetan teacher was talking about with it. I think all Mahayana Buddhist traditions do these animal release ceremonies, and I don't know about Theravada, so it might be more connected with the Bodhisattva vow of all beings in all realms. But Tibetans do huge, like, often fish release ceremonies. And one teacher was saying that they, this is superstition or not, they say that one of the main functions, way people see these, is you do these ceremonies when you or someone you love is sick or physically not well. It's like because it's like extending the life of animals is connected, or any living beings, is connected with extending your own life. So the merit or the effects generated from extending the life of others can heal, can extend your own life, basically. And the lives of others. So people will do this in Tibet and China. When, you know, somebody's sick, they're like, well, then let's do a lot of animal release ceremonies dedicated to these people. Yeah, yeah, interesting connection. Again, how much of that is exact connection the way we think of connections, and how much of it is just like something more mysterious or not at all. But may it be so, yeah.
I started to read Trust in Mind, and the introduction, and the text is wonderful, but the introduction really has me thinking about, it talks about all critters beside people operating first from the limbic brain, but when they're not worried or afraid, or then they're at ease. They don't have smartphones. they don't drive. They don't have
any more at ease than us,
they're
huh?
Far more at ease than us, and at being at ease, they're open. Those are the two words he uses in the introduction, and I was really thinking about that. And if you know animals, and for that matter, even plants, they're really open and at ease. And we have much to learn from them.
I think that's one reason maybe why people like pets.
Yes.
Is they remind them of a kind of just simplicity and
they're
ease.
Right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had a cat, and now one of our grandkids just got a cat. And they're right there for you.
They seem, they seem more in the present moment. We don't know, you know, what kinds of different stresses they might be doing. But again, because we understand that conceptual thought, conceptual grasping is like, is the subtlest kind of suffering. That's what we're addressing in a one-day sitting, really watching how that works as we start to constrict our ideas and the whole body gets tense and that open the hand of thought and the body relaxes.
Yes.
And I think animals are probably less involved in conceptual thoughts, so therefore they're maybe more at ease. And they also, because their conceptual thought isn't as developed, they're also limited in what they can do. So it's a trade-off.
That's why they're standards, though. By their standards, they do what they can do.
Yeah.
That's all they can do, and that's fine.
Yeah, and nothing's lacking.
Yeah.
I mean, they say when they describe in these six realms of sentient beings, the kind of psychological, the mental emotion that's connected with each of them that kind of represents them.
Yeah.
So like hell beings are, you know, dominated by anger.
Yeah.
Hungry ghosts are dominated by like greed. And the animal realm, the emotion, the dominant emotion is fear. And I think you can kind of see that. And like we set up, as humans, we set up kind of protection to, you know, we can like lock our doors so that the wild rhinos won't come in. You know, they walk around Santa Cruz all the time. We're like at the kind of top of the food chain, right? But like in the natural world of smaller animals, it's kind of like, I can imagine that, fear of being eaten, right? And death in various kinds of ways. You're just in the wild. That raw kind of animal fear makes sense. That would be a dominant emotion. So that we wish them protection from fear when we release them into the world of like. I was thinking, you know, maybe we should put them in the front because there's these cats. And I don't know if cats mess with crickets, but if I was one of them and I saw a cat like 1,000 times bigger than me, there might be some fear. Crickets, yeah. And
you know, with the last session, one point of a lot of people remarked that hearing the crickets and the second come from over there.
Yeah.
Of course, all the windows were open, but everybody sort of is hearing
That's our cricket world.
And hopefully they're not too territorial and they can share the bushes.
This is going to be a new territory for
them. We're putting the sharks in with the jets.
Well, maybe they can get trained by the wild crickets, because I think some people think, well, they might not survive that long because they've never known that spaciousness, bred in captivity. They, which may be a nice metaphor, right, for humans too. It's like, in a way, we're bred in captivity, right? our little, like, boxed-in world, that if we open that too much, really let go of everything, well, maybe you don't even know what to do, you know? And that's why we could say Buddha's teaching is the two truths are always unified. Like, if we just open to the ultimate reality, you know, completely separated from the conventional, we maybe would die.
Starve to death.
Yeah. Actually, it's too open without being, maybe not too open, but if it's open without the, you know, the integration with the appearances of where to find our food and stuff, then, yeah. And maybe there's no such thing as that. But maybe there is in the human realm, maybe like certain kinds of mental illness that is, you know.
So how can one develop more and more a sense of being at ease with whatever is?
Zazen. Yeah. I think Zazen is, you know, our family style of like our really direct way of just sit still, relax the body, relax the mind more and more, over and over. There's no end to it. Lifetime after lifetime, just sit, drop off body and mind. And that develops, seems like it gradually develops more ease with what's happening. Of course, there's infinite practices, but today, that's the one. So let's do it some more. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, particularly these crickets and worms sitting with us today, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.